Please be seated. Good evening. It's a great privilege for me to be able to share God's word with you tonight, and I especially want to extend a welcome to those who are new in this community. It's a great community to be a part of, and I want to share that when Jim Hart called me, I think it was, or emailed me in November about sharing a sermon tonight, I thought immediately of Bob Weber's situation because it is so central to what goes on here. He is so central. And I remember emailing him and saying that my only hope would be that he could be here for this. And obviously that hope hasn't been realized, and yet I know he is present with us. He is embodied in this community, his vision, his love, and his character. But I did think about what I should share in this situation, not knowing whether he would be able to be here or not. And the word that kept coming to me was the word hope. And as I thought about hope and prayed about what I might share, I thought of Colossians 1, which was read to us a few moments ago. In verse 27, Paul writes, "To them," and he's speaking of the saints, those who believe, "God has chosen to make known among the Gentiles the glorious riches of this mystery, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory." And so I want to take a few minutes to unpack just what Paul is trying to say here in these very poignant words. Let me read to you from two other translations. First, from Eugene Peterson's The Message. He writes, or translates, "The mystery in a nutshell is just this. Christ is in you, so therefore you can look forward to sharing in God's glory. It's that simple," is what he says. And in the New Living Translation, "And this is the secret, Christ lives in you. This gives you assurance of sharing his glory." I think both those translations help us. And the two things, I really want to focus on this last part of the verse, which in NIV is "Christ in you, the hope of glory." There's two sort of sides of this. First, there's the Christ in you side, and then the hope of glory side. And I'd like to take a few moments, like I said, to unpack those for you. Before I do, though, or as a means of getting at that, I want to share two stories. And the first one is from a novel that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It begins with these words. There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrubb, and he almost deserved it. And this is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis. It's a wonderful book, which I'm sure many of you have read many times. These are the first words of the novel. And as Lewis introduces this character, Eustace Clarence Scrubb, he describes immediately what an unsavory character he was. And so he says, for example, "I can't tell you how his friends spoke of him, for he had none." And he also says, he talks about his parents, whom he didn't call father and mother, but rather Harold and Alberta. He says of them, "They were very up-to-date and advanced people. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, and teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes. In their house, there was very little furniture and very few clothes on the beds, and the windows were always open." And so from this beginning, Lewis goes on to develop Eustace especially. As you know in the story, Eustace gets drawn into Narnia, and he travels with Prince Caspian and with Edmund and with Lucy. And at one point in the story, they land on an island, and Eustace, who is not only disliked by all, but dislikes all people, soon disappears on this island. And Lewis traces his journey away. He wanders off, and just to sort of condense what happens, stumbles into a dragon's den and onto a pile of gold. The dragon had just died. In fact, he watched it die. And so Eustace thinks he's found heaven. He lays on this pile of wealth and puts a variety of pieces of jewelry on himself and eventually falls asleep. When he wakes up, he finds out slowly but sadly that he's actually been transformed into a dragon. And it's interesting because he is such a mean-spirited character that Lewis says his first thought was now he was bigger than these other people so he could go scare them, because he just had a dislike for people. And yet Lewis then says, but his second thought was actually a longing for fellowship. Here's what Lewis writes. He, Eustace now the dragon, wanted to be friends. He wanted to get back among humans and talk and share things. he realized that he was a monster cut off from the whole human race. Now, I want to tell you part of another story that is of similar monsters. And this is a book that I read recently. I have two college-age sons, and both of them are attending John Brown University in Arkansas. And the younger of them is a freshman, and he began at John Brown this fall, and all freshmen were required to read a book, which is called To End All Wars by Ernest Gordon. There's been a movie made of this. The book was originally written in the 60s, but it's been redone, and it was put out as a movie a few years ago. In this book, Gordon describes his experience. He was a Scottish soldier who was taken as a prisoner of war by the Japanese during World War II. And he and his fellow soldiers lived through many years of tortuous life. And he describes this in great detail in the book. It's really worth reading if you haven't read it. But he describes in great detail the suffering they went through. And they were the ones who were responsible for building what's now known as the Bridge Over the River Kwai. So it describes that story. But it also describes the diseases they faced, the malnutrition. They dealt with malaria, diphtheria, dysentery, all kinds of nutritional diseases, etc. And what he noticed, in fact, he himself reached the point of death. And when he gets to that point in the book, his friends had basically given up hope for him to return to health. And he was now sleeping in what's called the death house, which was the hospital. And he was sleeping because the air was fresher next to the corpses of people who had already perished, because there was such a stench in the rest of the hospital. But what happened there is really significant. A person that he didn't especially know well, but who wanted to minister to him, came in, took him out of the death house, and made for him his own little hut to recuperate in. And this friend began to minister to him. And you have to imagine that this is a skin and bones person who's suffering from terrible diseases. And what his friend does is begins to just do basic things. By this time, he was paralyzed, by the way, from the waist down. And his friend begins on a daily basis to massage his legs to get blood flow to come back. And over time, Ernest Gordon begins to recover. His friend also gives him extra rations of food so that he can build up his nutritional base again as well. And over time, he experiences recovery. And in the rest of the book, this is about halfway through the book, in the rest of the book, he describes how something began to transform that camp. Whereas before, when he had gotten sick, he had noticed that as people were under this stress and under the suffering, they became more and more self-focused and selfish. In fact, he found it appalling how these prisoners of war, who were supposedly brothers, were stealing from each other. If one got too sick to care for, they would be discarded and their rations would be taken away from him and this kind of thing. So he really saw people become monsters. And yet what he experienced through this brother who ministered to him became a transformative experience. In fact, along with this brother, he and others began to do this. They actually began to give up their own rations, which were insignificant to begin with, to give up their own time, their own money, whatever they had, or own possessions, to care for others in the camp who were ill. And they began to, instead of treating each other despicably, in other words, ignoring the needs of others, they began to say, let's put the needs of others first, even in this terrible situation. And what he describes is very powerful, because he says hope began to rise in this community. That whereas there was no hope before, when everybody was out for themselves, as people began to give to each other and serve one another, a sense of hope rose up. In fact, in the book he describes the rise of a church, which he will call the church with no walls. He said it was a church that was all door. It was built in the jungle and there were no walls, but it was a church that people were drawn to because of the servant acts going on. Well, let's return to Colossians 1:27. Paul again talks about this mystery which he calls Christ in you, the hope of glory. And I want to just answer a couple questions. First of all, what is hope? Secondly, what is the hope of glory? And thirdly, what does Paul mean when he writes Christ in you, the hope of glory? Let's talk just a little bit about hope. The way we often use the word hope, in fact, I used it this way earlier this evening, is as a subjective desire for something. Like, I might hope that I live near St. Louis. I might hope that the Rams get to the Super Bowl. Or I might hope that my Los Angeles Dodgers get into the World Series. or I might hope that it doesn't rain tomorrow. As you know, biblical hope is not really about a feeling. It's not about a desire. It's not about something that we want to happen. But in fact, biblical hope, as Paul and others use it, is a reality. You know the idea of promise. When God makes Abraham a promise, he doesn't say, I want you to hope that this takes place. He says, this will take place, and you can put your faith in it. So hope in the biblical sense is an objective reality. It's something that's rock solid. We don't have many analogies in this world because almost all the things we think of are not solid, as much as we may want to make them solid. But hope biblically, in the way Paul uses it, is an objective reality that we can look forward to. When he says hope of glory, then, let's talk about glory. In a nutshell, glory simply is the revelation of God. We glorify God when we show God's character in our words and our actions, etc. Jesus is the one who most perfectly and fully reveals the very character of God. And he has said, and we heard from the passage in John, God had given Jesus his glory, and he had shared it with the disciples. Paul, in the same chapter, Colossians 1, says Jesus is what? The image of the invisible God. He is the one who shows us in the flesh what God is like. That is God's glory. So when Paul says hope of glory, he is talking about a certain reality that God's character will be revealed, and he is talking about it, fascinatingly, I think, being revealed in you and me. So the hope of glory of which Paul speaks is the promise, the objective reality that you and I will indeed display the very glory of God. And he uses this phrase to precede this, Christ in you. Now let me just talk about a common misperception, and it's probably one that all of us in this room are prone to. When Paul talks about Christ in you, the hope of glory, when we hear this word you, Y-O-U, we immediately think me. We think Paul is saying Christ in each of you as individuals, the hope of glory. Now, I do think Paul has that in mind, but Paul has something much bigger and grander in mind. In fact, the word you, Y-O-U here, is plural. He's talking about Christ in the body, and that Christ in the body, embodied in the body of Christ, is actually our hope of glory. If we look at the situation that Ernest Gordon describes in To End All Wars, toward the end of the book, he reflects on what he had seen in this horrific situation where people chose not to be out for themselves, but rather willingly to serve others under very dire circumstances. And he said he saw that men were still selfish, but he also saw and experienced love as he never had before, and I think if you read the rest of the book, as he probably never did again. And he said that the church, with all its perfections, and he's talking about the church without walls, the people in this prison camp that were serving one another, listen to what he says, was the only visible earnest or guarantee of something greater. What gave Ernest Gordon and the others in the camp any hope was the fact that they were embodying Jesus' servanthood to one another. And so he reflects back on this. And by the way, he became, I think, the dean of the chapel at Princeton Seminary later and lived a very productive life afterwards. But he carried this truth that Christ embodies himself visibly and gives us hope in our future through each other and through our relationships with each other. He says, this church set our feet on the way of an eternal pilgrimage and pointed us towards an unchanging goal, to the source of life and the city of God. We see something similar with Eustace Clarence Scrubb. You know from the book that he is led by Aslan up to a hill, and on this hill is a well. And Eustace is very itchy in his dragon skin, and he wants to go into the water, but Aslan says, you can't go in until you take your clothes off. And so Eustace says, well, I don't have clothes, I just have scales. So he begins to scratch at himself, thinking that like a snake he could shed his skin, and he does. but he's still itchy, and he still looks like a dragon. And two more times, he scratches his skin off. But at this point, Aslan intervenes and says he will take Eustace's clothes off. And with a deep claw into his chest, he rips the outer skin off. And Eustace is now freed from his dragon skin, but the job is not over. Aslan says, you must go into the water. And he lifts Eustace into the water. And when Eustace comes out, he is once again a boy. And Aslan doesn't leave him naked, but clothes him. And so now Eustace has been baptized. He has put off the old nature. Actually, Jesus has put off the old nature. He's been baptized into the new. What's fascinating, though, is that it's not just about Eustace, because even Lewis describes his re-encounter with his friends, whom he's now fond of. The first one he meets is Edmund. And Eustace tells him what had happened, and Edmund confesses that he's just as bad as Eustace. But fellowship is reunited. Eustace, who was a pariah before, who was outside the camp, has now been brought in through baptism, and after he talks with Edmund, he also then establishes fellowship with the other children, and the rest of the book, he's a different character. In fact, Lewis says, although the change wasn't always obvious, it had begun. And so we see in Eustace this baptismal change. But what's significant for our purposes, again, is that he is brought into fellowship. And those people, those friends, now become a source of hope for him. So when Paul says, Christ in you, the hope of glory, he means Christ's presence in us, my friends. And again, it is part of our cultural way of thinking to individualize what Paul says here. It's all about Jesus in me. But he has something much bigger in mind. It is Christ in us. Christ's presence in us is actually our hope that we will become like Christ. Listen to what Jesus says, and you heard this read from John 17. Speaking to the Father, he says, I have given them, the disciples, the what? The glory you gave me. Jesus gave his glory to us. So they may be one as we are one. That glory consists most fundamentally of a unity of relationship, because that is the Trinity. And when we are unified in purpose, we reveal something of God's character, who is a perfect unity of three persons. He says, I am in them, Christ in us, and you are in me. May they experience such perfect unity that the world will know that you sent me, and that you love them as much as you love me. You see, I think Jesus said exactly the same thing Paul did in somewhat different words. What Jesus' prayer for us was is that we might experience the glory of God, which we experience by living together in triune community. God has given us, who believe, his promise that we will indeed become like Jesus. This hope that we will become like Jesus and are becoming like Jesus is found tangibly, physically, really in our shared life together. Through our shared life, Jesus lives in us and makes himself known to us and through us. I believe he reveals himself to us through one another. And I believe, as Jesus says, that as he reveals himself to us through our relationships, that the world will see God's true character. We know Jesus better through one another. The world knows Jesus better as we share in his love. I want to encourage you to do two things this week. Well, lots of things, but I'll just mention two. I want to invite you to open up to Christ coming to you through other people. I think that I've been coming here for many years now, and I always leave somehow renewed, refreshed, and transformed, because Jesus comes to me through you. And yet I know that I have to be open to that. I have to be receptive, and I want to invite you and pray for you that you will be that. I also want to invite you to be Jesus, to be Christ to your brothers and sisters. So you need to receive Jesus as he comes to you and others. You also need to be Christ to others. as we saw so clearly illustrated in the story To End All Wars. I think, too, that even Bob Weber can experience through the Spirit Jesus in us, and that as we pray for him and as we share with him and communicate with him in these extremely trying times, he finds hope because he sees in us the reality of Jesus Christ. So my prayer for all of us is that we may respond in this way.